Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. This is a continuation of episode 137, where we are discussing a 1918 lecture by Max Weber titled Science as a Vocation, delivered in German to the University of Munich and translated by various authors since. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. Yeah, we covered a lot of ground in what was a fairly short reading, a lecture. And we are concluding on the discussion about the role of the teacher and what it means to teach and the environment of teaching and whatnot. I thought I might follow on with that and talk about an area where I wouldn't want to call it an objection, but it's one where my perspective might be a little bit different, that this is something that struck me as not quite the way that I think about things. It has to do with the idea of what is a full professor for? I tend to think about two different types of full professor, one of which seems to align with what Weber is considering to be an appropriate end path along like taking this role of the lecturer, speaking to a passive audience, a listening audience, imparting information, knowledge, whatnot. And that is sort of like the Uber specialist. The full professor is the Uber specialist. So you have a scientist who is absolutely expert in the field, should be talking in scientific terms, in very rational, very empirical terms about the knowledge that that professor has gained over the course of time. But then when Weber goes into sort of like saying, no, we don't want the personal perspective or whatnot, that part I struggled with because I also see the other side of, say, what I look to as a full professor, and that is precisely to be a leader of some sort. And that is to say the bridger of the vast gainings of intellectual knowledge and application to real life. Not to say that their voice, that they should be perfect in that expression, and I don't think anybody could ever be perfect in that expression, but I don't look to the scientific community to impart one form of knowledge at the expense of the other. I think of like, you know, you've got the full professor as the specialist, and then you have professors of, I don't want to call it professors of practice, but it's probably pretty close to that, of those who I turn to and say, okay, what do we do to make sense of all of this knowledge, especially the more that progress has happened to the point where we don't recognize or don't understand, like even those of us who are in the academic community, some of this scientific knowledge is so specialized, so advanced that we cannot possibly understand it. Who's building that bridge to say, okay, we need to know how to answer the question of, should we be using fill in the blank AI or whatever to solve problem Y, Z, W, what have you? And that's where I might depart from Weber's take, at least on my read.
So just one thing to start, I think that towards the end, he talks something about, you know, what science can offer, which is a little bit about, I think, in my translation, I think it was clarity that he talks about. And also he talks something about means and consequences, what doing something would mean and so on. So not advice directly, not direct recommendations, but some kind of, let's say, understanding and specifically analytical understanding, right? So I think that's one important thing that I think that he hints at. But while I haven't detected a lot of, let's say, dated arguments in terms of even when how it describes the different systems and what it means to be an academic, there is, I think, strong kernels that are still not just relevant, but also, you know, he hints at something that is profound. But I think there is a boundary condition, which is the kind of space he's talking about, which is the social sciences, which of course we're still emerging, and I don't think Weber had a chair in sociology, even though he's considered one of the founders of the discipline, you know, but it's in that space. It was not in engineering, was not in medicine, on and on. And he's also, and maybe because it is in those particular spaces that is much closer to how we think about history today, for example, this kind of almost like humanity type of space, I think there is a little bit of an implicit argument that it is knowledge for its own sake, that it's not necessarily directly applicable knowledge. But of course, this is all relative because there are disciplines and spaces in social science that emerge. Anthropology is a great example that it was emerged through the colonial encounter and had an application to basically prepare people to administer and understand the cultures in which the empires were taking over. So just one example in social sciences, that there is applications and there are uses of the knowledge. So it's not so black and white. But I think that is his assumption. And I think there is, of course, the assumption of a lot of power and the relationship with society that's a little bit different, that person can reason and exercise the job in such terms versus expectations. And I think we can go all the way through how, who, what is the money coming from, right? It's the students paying to hear the person talk. But if you have a different system in which you're getting either more indirectly because you're paying fees for the university as a whole, or you are in a public institution that is tax funded, but there are broader expectations about how society is benefiting from what is produced, right? So I think there's also this aspect to be thought. And finally, I think what is important is that it's a world that he's describing that is almost everyone operating independently versus thinking about the interdependencies, how people are working together, the teams that emerge, the lineages, the traditions, and so on, which, of course, bring all sorts of other questions, right? In terms of, for example, resources that are needed. And that is, I think, an important thing that is so different today, that especially if you're in natural sciences, right? How many people you need for a lab and who is paying for that research to take place and so on. He talks himself that, of course, is in that space is basically just the library that you need. Right? So I think there is a little bit of, as we think about that position, and thinking of the material conditions that existed in that system and what he's referring to and kind of the work that is being done, and how once we think about a different discipline, about different requirements for doing science, about different social expectations, about what universities or professors are for, you know, things get a little bit more complex.
Yeah, that's a great provocation, Tom. Like, what is a full professor for? And I don't think, yeah, Weber like unpacks that as much. But it does seem like there's, we can think of it as three elements. So there's the researcher, the lecturer, and the kind of tutor, if I use that word. And these aren't three tasks, right? These are almost like three people with their own values and cultures and ways of looking at the world. But the lecturer is the person who's just speaking to hundreds of people, and they probably have, that's where it aligns closest to Weber's point about being value-free, because these people are just listening and you have to be careful not to even implicitly lead them in towards your own ideological biases. But if we move from lecturing to kind of tutoring, which is like, you know, a smaller student to teacher ratio, suddenly the fundamental assumption Weber has, which is that the student is sitting silently, is no longer the case. It's if anything, you are now facilitating discussions and pushing minds and pushing people to critique each other and yourself. At that point, it might be fine, because Weber talks about how if you do want to share your more ideological perspectives, go do it in the public square, where you can be kind of critiqued and you have to defend your stance. Don't do it against these hapless students who have to sit and just listen. But if it's now the role of the full professor as tutor or as facilitator of a discussion, then even by Weber's own logic, you can probably bring in multiple things as long as they're open to critique. And then moving to researcher, which is more of, you know, pushing the frontiers of knowledge. There, I think Weber might have missed a step in his analysis where it's almost logically true. He talks about how innately you might not be good at research and teaching, but he misses the fact that if it is going to become so specialized till eternity, the way he says it, then almost by definition, over time, a super specialized researcher won't know enough about their field to teach like a survey course. You know, if this was in the 19 40s or 50s, I might be able to teach a course on just everything to do with management. But now we have, you know, OB separate, strategy separate, innovation management separate, operations separate, finance and accounting separate. And I wouldn't be able to teach a course that just covers all of those things because I'm existing in a space where the research has become more specialized. And so to the extent that a full professor is all of those things, then there's a lot of internal contradictions in the role between being a researcher, lecturer, teacher.
Yeah, I think that's even where the discussion about a professor of practice now comes in, because recognizing that that's the case, you start to create new forms of academic roles by which individuals become the authors of those survey courses because their orientation is more broad than specialized. I sort of like, I just described my line of work in particular.
So talking about the uses of academic jobs or the social connections or what they do, I think looking today is also important to think about how we talk about the role of, maybe don't say values, but political positions, ideologies, whatever, in the curriculum. We are talking about this in a time that there's been all sorts of debates about whether there is a particular affiliation among professors, right, in some places like the West that need to be more, they tend to be more left-leaning, how some ideas about social justice have perceived to have entered not just the curriculum, but also the organization of universities and how students are selected. Right. And of course, there has been a pushback, classes being canceled, the whole debate about, you know, it's okay to teach those topics or not. You know, we are living through this, right? Basically, a debate that is not just within universities, but at the social level with many important, you know, stakeholders on what is okay to teach, how to teach it, the role of ideology and so on. Right. So I think it's interesting to look back, both in the position of, as we said before, how much one can be very free on this, and also on what is expected from people's own consciousness or understandings about what is correct or not. I think there's a lot of implicit morality in what he's describing. But of course, as Tom said before, the challenge of putting forward such ideal, because when we do a close reading of Weber and his own assumptions and how he's describing some phenomena, we see some, let's say, perspectives that are more foregrounded than others and privilege. So in a way, I'm saying all of this to say it just got more complicated as well here. And one wonders how to uphold such ideal that he has and defends in the current times.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is also what it means to be a student has changed, where, and Weber kind of hints at this towards the end, where he says, and in fact, I noted that sentence down because I just liked it as a quote, where he says, "Allow me to take you back to America, because it is often possible there to see things in their most basic form, the most stripped down from tradition. It's a young country, but also the most, like, you know, utility function. Here are the incentives. Here's how it works." And then he goes on to say, you know, while throwing some shots at the US for not respecting anything, any tradition, any office, except unless it is the personal achievement of the person concerned. He goes on to say, for example, that the student sees himself as just someone who is, it's an exchange of the teacher's knowledge for my father's money. And he sets up that kind of vivid imagery. And he says, it's no different from how in the greengrocers, it's an exchange of their product for my mother's money. And given that that's how he sees the, let's say, the most crude form of it, where it's like an exchange of money for knowledge or whatever it is that you might want in self-interested pursuit. And if we tie it back to what he says early on in the lecture about the Americanization of everything over time, then we would expect what we perhaps see in some of our institutions, where it really is just a kind of a cash based thing. So the students come, is particularly in business schools, I would say, maybe not so in undergraduate studies, but come for the degree and what it confers. And they're essentially paying for that and the networks. And the classroom experience is not so much about growth and development and the kind of tutoring and the close, the vocational work, essentially, as it becomes more and more financialized, for want of a better word.
I'll make a statement to sort of pose as a question. It's because there's also this aspect of, when did critical studies become a thing? Because when you think about why do students go to receive higher education nowadays? And also the motivations behind some professors in terms of what motivates them to teach and to study. The aspect of the ability of academia to foster meaningful change, I think, has become such a strongly held theme. That alone, I think, really changes the dynamic of where professors, where students seem to, what their values are in engaging in the academic experience, it would seem to me. And it also kind of highlights the way that universities market themselves to prospective faculty and students. Maybe you see it differently in Europe, but here, anytime that I see a university advertise in television or online or whatever, what are they emphasizing? You come to us and we will give you the tools to change the world. And what that sort of encourages is a different dynamic in terms of what say, professors see themselves as doing on the podium. It definitely encourages students not to be passive observers, that they are there to learn how to foment change. Like I said, it's a statement, but it kind of poses a question. Am I right about this, or is there perhaps something I'm not capturing right?
I think there's a part of this. Yeah, it is an interesting thing, especially as we kind of try to bring this piece from the early 1900s to the early 2000s. Well, now we're a quarter way through the century, but it is an interesting provocation. I think there's an element in which it actually conforms to what Weber is talking about or conceptualizing, and there's one element in which it breaks from his assumptions. So let me go through both. So the element where it conforms is he's talking about this modernity as this kind of never-ending progress-oriented way of living. And to that extent, this idea of like, oh, the point of your degree is to go and change the world, to bring about progress, whatever progress means to whoever you are, almost fits. It makes sense that it's become more and more in that direction where the purpose is not to, you know, back in the more theocratic days, the purpose of scholarship is to commune with the divine and to just feel moral elevation. That was what you get out of it. But under a more rational, intellectual world, the purpose is to bring about change, is to, whether it's in the business school sense of entrepreneurship and disruption and move fast and break things, or in the kind of humanities sense of social progress and social justice and civil action. That part actually conforms to Weber's conceptualization, although he doesn't talk about it, but it follows from there. The part that breaks is that Weber does have an assumption of that there is an objectivity that we can strive to, and then which is makes sense for his time. Since then, with kind of postmodernism and the whole the movements around that, there's a bit more of a questioning of whether there is any way to be that purely objective. You know, even if you're teaching history, like whether had the US lost the Revolutionary War of Independence, George Washington might have been written as a whatever traitor or something like that. I don't know what the Brits would have written or rather than a hero. And so the idea that whose perspective is it every time you're making any knowledge claim, who is in power, who is deciding. So that kind of postmodernist view and the more like Foucauldian, I guess, view of critiquing knowledge itself has changed a lot since Weber's time. So that's part of the element that's bringing in this more critical perspective, because now there's no sacred knowledge anymore and no pure, you know, the view from nowhere is the phrase philosophers use for objectivity. But part of it also just fits Weber's conceptualization of never-ending progress. So the point of education then becomes to try to go change things.
A never-ending progress that ironically assumes that the system will stay, right? Even though he's talking about Americanization, but I think that's what is also happening, that to go back to the structure, the material conditions have changed and the people, the way people understand that have varied, right? Because that's the other thing. I think one of the things that when you're reading Weber and the broader work, it's a lot about conformity, obedience, the spirit of times, what it means, how people carry those ideas, but there's always heterogeneity and change and variation. So also I think it's important to think about that. But I wanted to open a different thread here, which is about technology. Because I think he has a quote somewhere when he's talking about, to go back to what you were both talking before about inspiration and all of that, which is also, you know, as Raheem was saying before, you know, that's another moment he talks about chance and where does inspiration comes from and how it's a decisive factor, that he talks a little bit about how, you know, we cannot pursue it directly, but also he seems to assume that people just have or not. There is one point that he talks about mechanical aids and the idea that whether or not one can almost outsource. And this I'm kind of, you know, reading into a little bit that he was talking about, because he's talking about calculation, rationalization, all of those things, you know, whether all of, you know, if science is pursued in such a way, where this novelty in the inspiration comes from. And I think it's interesting to talk about this in the age of the popularization of AI and the assumption that such tools can, well, many people say they can enhance and improve, but regardless, they can certainly reconfigure and change the way academic work is accomplished, from writing your lecture notes or writing the papers or summarizing ideas or conducting research. And of course, that is where ideology is important as well, because with these technologies, there is a lot of ideology. And one of the things I want to bring, there will be so much to talk about, but it's the participation of professors, scholars, in this ideology, sometimes for private gains. And I think that one of the things that's interesting, that I think, regardless of the point, whether knowledge can ever be neutral or free, and of course, as Raheem said very well, we have a different understanding about epistemic processes. But I think the point of seeing one's role in an organization, in a profession, as trying to be, as a scholar, disinterested, or at least being cautious about one private gains from one public function, as would be if someone would be a scholar in a public organization, but regardless, by being member of a profession, I think it's important, because I think there is a lot of people that are championing those tools that have their own side businesses in creating those tools, right? And use the role and the prestige and the legitimacy of being academics, right? So people that would be able to assess the validity and relevance of knowledge claims to endorse such tools. So I think that's an interesting point, that Weber, in a way, seems much more timely and prescient in warning about this indirectly. And I'm, of course, bringing, of course, the broader Weber and the whole idea about bureaucracy and what it means to have an ethos and have a public function, but to understand what the importance of understanding our own limits, right? And what I would think he would, if he would say this, he would basically, that's basically trying to, form of misconduct, trying to use one's position in an organization or in a field to accumulate private gains. So I think that's an important thing to flesh out and relevant to our current debates.
Absolutely. And there's all sorts of different varieties of misconduct that we could cover. I'll obviously start with the one that you raised, the conflict of interest. It's a difficult thing because, you know, on the one hand, when we talk about the incentives for pursuing science and pursuing as a vocation, the vocation would imply, if you really took it as a vocation, it would imply that you're doing things for their intrinsic good, that you are doing something good for society, that you are doing something that is going to be helpful. It's about what you're doing for the world without necessarily benefit to yourself. But the way in which we measure people, we, the broad we, is rather a competitive sport. And we've never really been able to reconcile the fact that when it comes right down to it, people aspire to be recognized. People aspire to gain status, prestige. You know, they want something back for the work that they do. And, you know, sometimes that takes people down a pretty dark path. I don't necessarily want to get down into the dark side of it. It's just hard to imagine any sort of a, you know, group of human beings where you have a pyramid, and we're almost going back to our episode on the Peter Principle here. There is a desire, like full professorship is something that is desired, whether it manifests as tenure. I mean, how many academics are really putting themselves through the meat grinder trying to get into the tenure track and to get that because of the tremendous incentives and the benefits that tenure provides. So as long as you have that, there's always going to be, it seems to me, like just natural temptations. And unfortunately, what we as human beings are probably not all that good at is identifying when people are doing things for their own benefit versus when people are doing things for others' benefit. It's really hard to prove or even identify when conflicts of interest arise. Fraud, although the tools are getting much better at identifying when fraudulent papers are being written, it's still a problem. And unfortunately, I don't know that the sanctions or the system that is supposed to protect science from those types of things is adequate or even could ever be adequate.
Yeah, and this speaks to perhaps shortcoming or a short-sightedness even in the Weber piece itself, which is that idea that can humans just agree to be part of something that is so, you know, self-surpassing. So the way Weber puts it up is that as a scientist, you're someone who should be putting your head down obsessively, diligently, working hard with inspiration to come up with something in a very specialist niche place that in 10 to 15 years will become obsolete. And you should be happy about the fact that what you know, your theory is surpassed with some greater knowledge or some greater truth. You know, who knows how true it was even then, but it's certainly not true now that people are willing to just gladly self-sacrifice in that sense. I think even then he was probably underestimating how many scientists, you know, even in the natural sciences want to come up with that, the theory of everything, the unified theory of everything. And then they, you know, put their name to it and they are known for it. So I don't think even then too many scientists wanted their findings to just be brushed away 10, 15 years after they're dead because it's replaced with new knowledge. But if we add that idea that you're not actually happy with being self, you know, that self-denying or self-sacrificing with the kind of capitalist world we live in, and then the lack of meaning in the scientific system brings you towards either pursuing kind of self-aggrandizing meaning. So things like, I want to be a chaired professor and have these kind of credentials and so on and so forth. Or to he got more hedonistic, you know, I want to make this much money or start a company and so on and so forth. So in some sense, I think Weber was a bit naive in thinking that would work, this idea of, given that science is anyways endless, you know, whatever paper you write, how much ever hit it is, some point people will stop reading it. It's not like back in the day, again, in the more theocratic systems where people are reading the classics or the, you know, St. Augustine or St. Thomas Aquinas again and again and again for hundreds of years. So at some point people will stop reading you. And so then you can't have that work be the source of meaning and legacy. And so then people start doing all of these other things that conflict with the project of science.
But I think that's why it is interesting, the choice of the word vocation, because it has a religious dimension. And I mean, we live in a society that maybe people not necessarily believe in God or go to church or whatever. But one, the church, the Catholic Church, one example, but many others have been the template for organizing. There still are, one of the oldest bureaucracies that have ever been created and is going on strong. And I think that is also, of course, the values, meanings, and ideas that have infused our culture. And of course, Weber has a whole thing about the Protestant ethic and so on that we won't go into here. But I think what is interesting is that the same way in which he talks about charisma, then he brings his idea and says, what means to me a leader, what kind of authority can exist from that? And in a way, I think charisma in his treatment, I think one can almost assume that it's almost coded as negative, or at least some shortcomings are pointed out. I think that here, vocation is seen as a positive or almost like an implicit condition, because I think that, it, as you're saying, Raheem, right, I think the idea is that for this to work in his assumption, in those material conditions, and in his ideal, and in his value of non-value, value-free or disinterested, there needs to be a sense of, let's say, awe and belonging and almost transcendence that comes from almost being self-denying, right? Which may exist in some religions, right? And think of Catholic religion here, about this whole idea of being oneself, that there is some, I imagine that people that feel a calling for being, you know, part of the clergy, for example, feel that they are working to a higher purpose, that they're carrying out orders or missions that, you know, are given because they are an important value that should be championed and so on, right? So I think there is a little bit of this, which, you know, this is a very paternalistic religious way to read this, but one can also read in a different way that this is about being human, right? That think of us as a species level, and I think more in collective terms, right? So you can also do a more ecological way of reading that what it means for humans to survive and go on. And one can insist so much on oneself, but also once one contemplates mortality and what it is, that, you know, how brief our existence is versus what nature is and what the species are, one, I think, can have a different conception. So either if you start with the more traditional religious, Catholic, whatever, or just more, I don't know, understanding nature and so on, I think that both can go into this sense that he assumes, which almost like the culture, the core mechanism for this apparatus as he describes to work is such need. Of course, how to cultivate that, whether people would resist and embrace it, to what extent the material conditions are going to confirm and socialize people into that is a whole ballgame that I think that is exactly the problem.
Yeah, I'd like to follow on with that because it spurred a thought about taking medicine, for example, which has definitely been a profession that has been considered as a vocation. The intrinsic aspect of it is also what permits, I mean, you know, the feeling of self-sacrifice is what permits some of these scientists slash professionals to be able to carry on their work under the worst of conditions. And I usually highlight medicine because I can't think of anything that is more stressful, more, you know, challenging than being, say, a brain surgeon who is going to be operating, you know, having the life of somebody in their hands, you know, for 30 hours, or practically a 30-hour surgery with a partner, trying to repair what is nobody would have even thought of repairing 15, 20 years ago. And now, of course, you know, you can do it with lasers. You don't need 30 hours of cutting. But there's also maybe more to the point about prestige and celebrity and things of that regard. There's also the challenge of, well, even though Weber, in the context of lecturing, of course, the audience is passive, when science mixes with policy, and we have things like the pandemic, where we turn to the medical community for answers, answers that don't exist scientifically, but we have no one else really to turn to. And so they tell us what it is that we should be doing. In some ways, some of it may have been somewhat concocted because they recognize that there's limits to how much humans are going to be able to constrain their own behavior, even in the face of a very transmittable disease, and then take the criticism for it. The idea of, you know, maybe I'm not getting, I'm sort of going astride of science as a vocation, but the vocation of, like, it's sort of like the burden of being the smart guy, which is not necessarily to say scientist, but a knowledgeable person whom people turn to a leader, even though they are not technically, to include in Weber's terms, really intended to be leaders. They just simply happen to be the smartest person in the room with the best chance of delivering an answer where no one else can provide an answer, and then be willing to accept the consequences that they may very well have gotten it wrong, which has been charged in some of this. I don't know if I'm making a lot of sense, but this is what was going through my mind, because this is one of the reasons why science itself is under so much pressure nowadays.
No, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I thankfully have never had to deal with the burden of being the smart guy. So, but just to another angle on that, I think, Tom, is so when Weber talks about the, you know, teachers versus leaders, he does kind of get at that. But at the same time, even though both are translations, the whole lecture is called Science as a Vocation, it probably is better to think of it as academia as a vocation. And maybe that distinction was less important back then, but now over the 20th century and into the 21st, a lot of science happens in the private sector outside of academia anyways. And that changes the whole institutional setup, entirely. And of course, people can choose then whether they get into the vocation of academia or to doing science elsewhere. I think just this week, there was a paper out of University of Chicago on the AI brain drain and how a lot of machine learning PhDs are naturally choosing to go into industry because of the high salaries, which in some sense is just simple incentives. But the other thing is, you know, ties into Weber's point about owning the means of production as a scholar. You know, machine learning or whatever, AI research, LLM research is such that it's very, very expensive. The means of production is compute, and even your university can't provide you that compute. Forget about you owning it as a, you know, old school scientist in your aristocratic manor estate. Even your a public state university or big university can't offer you the kind of compute that these private sector frontier labs can offer you. So you go where the means of production are, and if they are in the private sector, then the whole vocational component is really kind of out the window. All of which is to say, I mean, that's kind of at the phenomenon level what's happening now, but that's also why I do think what Weber meant really was academia as a vocation, also given his dual emphasis on teaching and research through this whole lecture.
So as I think we start to wrap up, I cannot help but think that we should, of course, talk about Marianne Weber, which was an intellectual, besides being married to Max, and has an important role in finishing Economic Society, like important work. He only finished 3 chapters. It's not very clear how much she wrote herself, but certainly that was a huge undertake. And, you know, there's reason to believe that it was not just editorial work, of course. The reason why those ideas got to us and are finished and make sense is largely due to her. But regardless of that, her participation in Weber, she also has authored stuff, right? And I think one of her essays is looking at, for example, authority and autonomy in a marriage, in which she's, you know, does a historical comparison, looking across different eras and how the position of women has been one of subjugation and subordination to men in marriages. And now she advocates for autonomy, right, in order to have more balanced couples. And she talks about how industrialization and other forces have been eroded, potentially that structure, and, you know, seems to be leading that. But anyway, this got me thinking, what would be this idea of vocation if we start from a different perspective? I mean, I cannot, of course, have the perspective of a woman, but let's think about the perspective of anyone that is subordinate in the system, or one that wants to see not just obedience and conformity, but change. One that sees that the system, besides the internal problems that Weber's talking about, has also external problems. One that wants to question who is the student body or the people that are allowed to exercise this profession. We almost, you know, Weber takes for granted, and we, in our conversation, we took for granted that the professors are males. So what it means to think about different type of material conditions and subjective that honor variety of human experiences and unique opportunities, demands, challenges that this brings. I don't have any kind of clear statement, but I just could not help wonder one thing, for example, when we're talking about the sense of selflessness and continuity and perpetuity, how women as the people that make our species go around, or maybe I should say people with wombs, right? Or people that, you know, carry babies, to be more inclusive, have that role. And it's interesting that he's talking about this, and we talked about this, of course, on this dilemma that one can have about wanting to be seen and remembered and recognized. But one can also think about the work of literally birthing humanity, right? And what it would mean if we start this idea of vocation from that kind of job and work and activity and purpose. How would it be academia if we start from that perspective? I don't know the answer. I'm sure many feminists and others have looked into this, probably a topic for a future episode, but I think it's just important to bring it up.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, like you said, Pedro, in many ways, the virtues of a vocational approach to science that Weber discusses are more abundantly evident in these historical female figures in science, you know, whether Weber's own wife or, I don't know, Rosalind Franklin in the invention of the DNA, Marie Curie, her daughter, Irene Curie. A lot of them were kind of pursuing it in, despite not getting as much credit and, you know, despite the self being belittled or placed second. They were still out there doing it for its own sake, which is another phrase we find in Weber, which I didn't bring up earlier, but so doing it for its own sake. So in some sense, the template is actually elsewhere. But then, of course, the irony is that, you know, the systems are encouraging more towards, rather than, okay, now we need everyone to be a little more self-denying. It's more like, so that, of course, so that you level the playing field, but we need everyone to compete now on an ego basis rather than the vocational setup that, which again, I do think is a bit naive from Weber to see it that way. But it is so interesting. And I've only thought of it when you brought it up, Pedro. So thanks for bringing that up about how actually the virtue that Weber is describing is almost more evident in the historical figures of women in science.
I think in my closing reflection, I'll go in a slightly different direction, because one thing that we've been grappling with, and we've been grappling with this for a whole time, is the whole idea of academics, the body of academics being viewed as elitist. And some of the content of this paper has sort of spurred some thoughts about what does that really mean in sort of the ongoing discussion, because the concerns about, say, the separation of the scientist from the public has, and the more that we specialized or whatever, it's taken on even added meaning nowadays as we start to see a lot of social pushback against science, against the use of science as a means for finding answers to what we may say are maybe not everyday problems, but just in general for finding ways forward of everybody being the beneficiaries of the progress that are ongoing. Elitism has been a very recently level charge that the scientific community has somehow gotten out of touch. And so as I'm reading through this article and thinking about, you know, well, again, as a vocation, my interpretation of the use of that word and or the word profession is actually should be oriented on bringing what is out there, the specialized knowledge that's being gathered, either making it accessible or providing some benefit back to society. Business of elitism or the discourse on elitism is sort of like in part might be a reason for us to take another look at who we are, what we're doing as scientists, as the community of academics. Have we detached ourselves from society to the point where they don't understand us? Can there be something that we do better to repair whatever bridges we have had with them so that we aren't just out there, you know, talking down to the world from the ivory towers?
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.